you have successfully downloaded the latest from Peter B. Collins. Nice going. My thanks to the people who support this program by subscribing. Susan Fellows, David Pennell, Deborah Newell, and Stuart Smith, just to name a few. You can do it too at peterbcollins.com, but perhaps you already have. And thanks for putting up with the latest dislocation here at Malfunction Junction. Many of you had to re-enter your information and resubscribe because we changed our software. And if you haven't done so, make that your gentle reminder, all right? Today we bring you another episode in the Boiling Frogs podcast series, co-hosted with Sibel Edmonds. And this is a powerful voice, Peter Van Buren, who is in the process of being fired at the State Department. Why? Because he told the truth about the mess in occupied Iraq when he was sent there to spend our money on reconstruction projects. It's a powerful interview, and I do have one apology in advance. On the day we recorded this with Peter Van Buren, we had a little gizmo blow up here at the secret studio, and so the audio, mainly on my voice, is diminished, but you can understand it, and you can certainly hear the comments of our guest. So I'm sorry for the substandard audio you're about to hear, but the content is very powerful. I think you'll agree. If so, send me an email, peter@peterbcollins.com. One more thanks, John Coltrane, for our opening music today.
Welcome to Boiling Frogs.
Everybody knows that the dice are loaded. Everybody rolls with their fingers crossed. Everybody knows the war is over. Everybody knows the good guy's lost. Everybody knows the fight is fixed. The poor stay poor, the rich get rich. That's how it goes.
Everybody knows, but do they? NSA's illegal domestic wiretapping, FBI's national security letters, state secret privilege, TSA's 1 million-plus no-fly list, persecution of government whistleblowers, perpetual wars, rendition and torture. Can you feel the water boiling?
Welcome to The Boiling Frogs. With Sibel Edmonds, I'm Peter B. Collins. And as Sibel just mentioned in the introduction, persecution of government whistleblowers. That's something that we've covered in depth here on The Boiling Frogs interview series. And today we welcome one of the more recent whistleblowers who maintains a very high profile and continues to be outspoken. His name is Peter Van Buren. He's put in decades at the State Department, and after he completed a tour in Iraq, he published a powerful book last year called We Meant Well, How I Helped Lose the Battle for the Hearts and Minds of the Iraqi People. And I interviewed Peter Van Buren two or three times after the book came out, and have been very impressed with his knowledge and his willingness to speak out about issues that he has encountered. Peter Van Buren, welcome to The Boiling Frogs.
It is a great pleasure to be back again with you, and thank you for having me.
Well, and I appreciate your book, and you know that. You and I spoke about that when you published it last year. And you recently wrote an article that was posted at Tom Dispatch, and Tom Engelhart was one of your editors and helped you with the book. And in it, you go to bat for other people in your situation and also talk about the retaliation and reprisals that you have endured because you published a book. And Peter, as we talked about before the show started, Sibel Edmonds is in the process of publishing her own book and has had to tangle with the FBI censorship routine, as you did with the Department of State. Why don't we give a little background to listeners who might not be familiar with your story or your book. After you returned from Iraq, you put pen to paper or clacked away on a keyboard, and in a humorous but very compelling way, you described the follies of our occupation of Iraq, the near billion-dollar embassy that we're now scaling back, as you had predicted in the book, and you told a lot of truth. Tell us about the process your book went through before you published it, and if you expected the kind of retaliation that you're now seeing.
It was very interesting because the State Department is a bureaucracy, and I had worked within it for over 20 years. And for 20 years, they lost my paperwork and misplaced my stuff and mailed my household effects to Tokyo when they should have gone to Botswana and vice versa. So all these terrible bureaucratic mistakes piled up over the years, and I was always the brunt of them. But every once in a while, the lightning strikes in the right place. The State Department has a very different pre-publication clearance process than other agencies, largely because we tend to deal more with unclassified material. And that requires only a 30-day suspension period during which the State Department reviews your book. And if they do not approve it or disapprove it at the end of 30 days, by default, it's considered approved.
Mm-hmm.
Now, in most cases, what happens is the State Department waits till 29th day and says, we need more time, and that's how this process unfolds, unless, of course, you're a former ambassador or secretary of state, and then your book gets pushed through very quickly. But for a guy like me, the expectation was that 29 days later, I'd be told, need more time. Unfortunately for them, and fortunately for me and everyone else out there whose First Amendment rights allow them to listen to me, the State Department didn't process my stuff fast enough. And so 30 days passed, in fact, 45 days passed, and I was free to publish. Call it a mistake. Maybe they forgot me. Maybe they misplaced me. Who knows? But the State Department green-lighted the book, and off it went to the publisher.
And we've seen recent cases where Valerie Plame Wilson's book was heavily censored by the CIA, and she and her publisher decided to actually show, via blacking out, areas that had been excised by the censors. And then there's the Abel Danger guy, who published a book and went through this at the Defense Department, and they ended up buying out the entire inventory of his book in order to take it off the market. So you dodged a couple of possible figurative bullets there. And I'm curious, immediately after the book was published, did they throw a party for you at Foggy Bottom and let you talk to the staff there about your experiences and what you recounted in the book?
Well, almost. If you count pulling my security clearance, kicking me out of the job, throwing me out of the building, banning me from entering the facility, taking away my access to the computer network, and doing just about everything but taking a 2x4 to the back of my head, a party, then yeah, that's pretty much what happened.
Well, you haven't lost your sense of humor, Van Buren.
No, I've got two choices, and one of them is sense of humor, and I'm gonna stick with that one for now. First of all, I am jealous of Tony's book about Abel Danger and that he got to go to a second printing with the first one sold out to the Department of Defense.
Yeah.
I actually extended that offer in writing to Secretary of State Clinton and, in fact, offered her wholesale price on it. I never heard back. And if she is listening, I'll just mention that we do have a few copies left. The State Department is not as sophisticated in these matters as the CIA or the FBI or Department of Defense. And that's largely because of lack of practice. I am told that I am the first Foreign Service officer who has ever written a critical book about the Department of State while still employed.
Mm-hmm.
In 223 years of existence, since Thomas Jefferson was the Secretary of State on through the giants who once ran this organization, I am the first one to sit down and write something critical while still employed. So you give them credit for trying, but they just were out of practice.
Yeah.
That didn't stop them, though, because 5 days before the book was going to be published, the State Department, in the form of a letter from one of a principal deputy assistant secretaries, a nice person, actually, I don't know, I've never met her, named Dana Smith, wrote to the publisher and discovered that one of my chapters had what she considered classified material in it. And she demanded this be redacted, but for convenience sake, she actually sent the chapter with the alleged classified passages underlined by fax to my publisher. You just got to wonder sometimes, if these are the people in charge, how come things work out the way they do? Anyway, we kind of told her that all that information was available on Google. In fact, I actually conducted a Google search and recording, you know, Google tells you it takes 0.0009 seconds or something. The most critical piece of information that I allegedly disclosed, that the CIA had once operated in Mogadishu, I obtained from watching the movie Black Hawk Down.
Right.
Which is probably unclassified, but I'll have to double check.
Yeah.
So they're a little bit disorganized at state, but when they want to, they can actually get their act together and really put some whoop on somebody, and that's unfortunately what's happened. As they've gotten smarter, the penalties have gotten a little bit sharper.
Now, Sabel, I'd like you to compare notes with Peter Van Buren here, because when you were fired from the FBI and then subjected to gag orders under the state secret privilege, they even managed to declare classified things like your birthday and the college degrees that you've earned here in the United States. So what is your comment on the treatment that Peter has received from the Department of State?
Wait a minute. I want to know her birthday before we go on here.
That's right, Steve, because one of the things that I told them and I told the media, I said based on their criteria and what they classified and actually declared as a state secret privilege, and believe me or not, Peter, the court and both the lower court and the appellate court actually granted the FBI DOJ their request, saying that, yes, her birthplace, her place of birth, her date of birth, and even where I went to university here, which is George Washington University and GMU, that they were classified, my degrees, the topics, the subject area for my degrees were all classified and covered by the state secrets privilege. And I told them, I said, okay, that means they have to come and take away my passport and my driving license. You know, both documents have my date of birth and place of birth, basically my passport. And they didn't. It just, you know, shows you how ridiculous, how ludicrous these agencies can be, both in terms of secrecy, unjustifiable secrecy, but also it shows you that the courts, the federal courts, no longer recognize any kind of separation. They see themselves as part of the same executive branch, because I thought surely these judges, you know, first with the lower court and then later with the appellate court, three judges on that panel, they would look at the FBI and DOJ and say, I mean, that's ludicrous. I mean, this is absolutely ludicrous, but they didn't. They granted not only that, when the judges asked the FBI and DOJ attorneys, and Peter, they had these 12, 13 guys walking in, 12, 13 attorneys, and here I'm standing there with one attorney, and they said, when the judge asked for explanation, the criteria under which they classified this, the FBI and DOJ, they said, it is so classified that we can't let you know, Judge. First, you and your court clerks have to get security clearance, and even then, we're going to be in camera and telling you, basically, whispering in camera. Again, they were all granted. Everything they asked for, they got from the court, which basically tells you about the sorry state of our country. And for those people who are still under this illusion that we have the separation of powers and the checks and balances, just all those illusions that many in our country still hold on to. And it's not true. It no longer exists. But one of the things that I was going to, I'm shocked. I mean, this is actually funny, but it's also shocking with the State Department, all these bunglings. But when I was in the FBI, the biggest reason for the state secrets privilege, and most of my case actually involved the State Department, Peter, and it was not the FBI. In fact, the targets of our investigations, and those investigations were shut down because of the pressure through both White House and the State Department, because they kept citing sensitive diplomatic relations. Because they said, well, you know, Turkey is an extremely important ally in our fight against terror and all the wars we engage in. So a lot of troubles, a lot of things that happened was with due to the FBI being ruled by the State Department. And many of our counterintelligence investigations that actually should have been transferred to criminal or counter-espionage investigations had to do with not only foreign targets, but people within the State Department.
And one of the key subjects there that Sibel has covered is Mark Grossman, who was the Undersecretary of State for many years, and is now the replacement for Richard Holbrooke as the special envoy to Afghanistan and Pakistan.
What Sibel is talking here is the overclassification of everything and the way that that is used as a blunt instrument to silence anyone on any grounds. Since 9/11, the United States has become a much more fearful place, to our own loss, I'm afraid, and one only has to mouth the word security for people to suddenly fall into line. Anyone who's traveled through an American airport in the last 10 years understands how crude that tool is. When Transportation's TSA says, well, security requires us to grope you, grab you, go through your purse, go through your pockets, take away your water bottles, whatever, from the silliest things to the most tragic and serious things, that blunt tool of security has become the government's weapon of fear, weapon of silence, weapon of quieting dissent. The United States periodically goes through these motions. You can look back at the Red Scares of the 1920s and the Communist Scares of the 1950s, but I never thought I would see it in my lifetime, and Sibel and I are simply the latest victims in a long string of terrible, terrible acts following 9/11.
It's amazing. Actually, it's really interesting. I love this interview because here we have two people with two different, who have been exposed maybe to do two different sides of the State Department, and you are the one who've been there for decades. But most of the investigations that we covered, Peter, they actually dealt for the time period 1996 till 2001. And I know a lot of bunglings and scandals and fiascos have been exposed by the CIA. But I can tell you that between 1996 and 2001, whether on heroin and drug-related, narcotics-related cases, and some of these cases were joint operations by the FBI and the DEA, Drug Enforcement Agency, the biggest antagonist, the biggest criminal entity in terms of operations that FBI has already, you know, was already admitting to when I was working there was the State Department. State Department was exposing consistently undercover operations targeting certain diplomatic foreign targets who were top tiers in heroin distribution, bringing them into the United States. They were actually jeopardizing DEA investigations by going and tipping off the target. And where the line, the separation ended between the State Department and the CIA was extremely blurry. And after 9/11, immediately after 9/11, some of the most valuable suspects for 9/11 got off the hook, and quietly, secretly, they were taken out of the country because of the State Department. So it's very interesting because when it comes to operations, I mean, even with the Defense Department whistleblowers we have and also the DEA, there is no more evil agency than the State Department. And as I said, the lines are really blurry. Which ones are the criminal CIAs or which ones are the criminal traitor diplomats there?
Well, let me bring it right back to today's newspaper and talk about the State Department's role in bringing the current slash soon-to-be former dictator of Yemen, Mr. Salah, to the United States. Salah was issued a visa by the Department of State that allowed him to travel to America for, quote, medical treatment, unquote. He's in New York right now. I don't think he's really in a hospital, trussed up in a bed or anywhere. I think his medical treatment is more theoretical than anything else. But the Pentagon wanted to speak to Salah about some potential war crimes that he may be connected with, and the State Department asserted that he has diplomatic immunity in the United States and blocked the Pentagon from actually speaking to him. And so the things that you talk about where the State Department has acted across purposes to the United States, I'm afraid, are not confined to history, but in fact unfolding in front of us right now.
Right.
And that's very interesting. I just want to add that I've been trying to sound the alarm about the admission of Saleh to the United States because I think very much like our admission of the Shah and to a lesser extent Ferdinand Marcos in the 1970s and 80s, that we put ourselves at great risk in other parts of the world for blowback that most Americans can't even anticipate.
And this is one of those who could have anticipated it questions that the media will ask after things happen. Most Americans were unfamiliar with the situations of the Shah and Marcos that you described, and were then suddenly surprised when we wake up one morning and find that we're not as popular in those countries as we used to be. Meanwhile, the State Department legal advisor, Harold Koh, has sent a letter to the Pentagon just Monday of this week opposing their request to subpoena Salah for war crimes questions. What the State Department's role in all this, or why they would choose to do something like that, remains something of a mystery. It's something that is very hard to answer as it happens. It's only years later, as whistleblowers and Freedom of Information Acts reveal the layers under the layers about why the State Department would support a war criminal in the United States.
And Peter Van Buren, the article that I referred to, and we'll link to it in the show file at Boiling Frogs Post, you start off by recounting the unprecedented crackdown on whistleblowers that's been conducted by the Obama administration, even as they claim to be the most transparent administration in American history. And they were given a secret award for transparency last year that we talked about quite a bit on this podcast. But you start by acknowledging the way that John Kiriakou, a former CIA officer, is being prosecuted because he disclosed information related to the waterboarding of Abu Zubaydah, who essentially was treated as a human experiment subject to tweak the waterboarding process. And I believe Zubaydah was waterboarded more than 100 times, or at least close to that. And Kiriakou went public with this years ago. His book, I believe, was published in 2007. And yet the Obama administration has decided this year, 2012, to prosecute John Kiriakou.
One of the things that's very important to understand here is that from the time that the Espionage Act, which is the law that's being used against Kiriakou, was voted by Congress in 1917 until 2008, the United States government used that act against its own employees for whistleblowing three times in the course of 90-some years.
Mm-hmm.
The Obama administration currently has six prosecutions underway under the Espionage Act, double the number in the entire previous history of the United States. This remains very, very chilling because the Espionage Act carries as its maximum penalty life in prison, and it is being used against whistleblowers under the most egregious of circumstances. Whatever Kiriakou did or didn't do was 2 years old before the administration decided it was time to drop the bomb on him. And it remains a very difficult society when whistleblowers have to weigh not only their jobs, their careers, but their very freedom against the commands of conscience that say, we need to tell you what we are seeing. Kiriakou's case brings up another point, and one that's perhaps even sadder, and that is the way that the government is using extra-legal tools, if you will, to destroy the careers and lives of whistleblowers. I know Sybil will want to weigh in on this, but I wanted to share that in Kiriakou's case, for example, the CIA also fired his wife, who worked for them, while she was on maternity leave as they indicted her husband.
Wow.
In the case of other whistleblowers, Thomas Drake at the NSA is one that stands out.
Mm-hmm.
His life was destroyed in the process of, quote, investigating him.
Well, and as you point out in your article, Drake is a whistleblower of the most positive kind. He worked inside his agency,
yes,
to try to persuade them to avoid a big boondoggle. And it had to do with software that could be used to sift through our records and data, the data mining approach to gathering information. And the NSA blew over $1 billion on a system that would not protect the rights of American citizens when the software that Drake was preferring and trying to get his bosses to adopt only cost $3 million and did have built into it ways of protecting Americans from illegal surveillance in the United States.
And this is what's very important, is people like us are oftentimes tarred with brushes that we're spies, that we're enemies of the United States, that we're not trying to do something right. In fact, we're trying to do something very wrong. Instead, let's look at Thomas Drake. He tried to call out the government on two very important things. One was waste. And in these times, with money the way it is, waste is something that we all need to be very aware of. And the other was illegality. He wanted to make sure that the NSA would follow the laws, follow the Constitution in its actions. Those are not the actions of a leftist or an anarchist or what have you. They're the actions of a patriot, someone who says, I can make America better. I want to help make it a better place, and I want people to understand what their government is up to so that they can fulfill their obligations in a democracy by voting and acting in ways that citizens are expected to act. That's a very different characterization than what the government tries to do when it smears whistleblowers as some kind of a bad guy.
And Peter Van Buren, you are not the first whistleblower that Sabell and I have talked to on this series. We've talked to people at the DEA, the NSA, the CIA, the FBI, the Border Customs and Border Patrol, and in each of these cases, people did not seek the whistleblower label. And when you ask them, did you intend to be a whistleblower, they say, no, I was following the routines, the procedures, and the law. And when I discovered wrongdoing in my government job, I reported it to my superiors. And so I'd like to address in your own case, you wanted to tell the truth, but you did not fancy yourself as a whistleblower, did you?
I even find that term uncomfortable, and I don't use it myself. Others have applied it to me, and I accept that it's probably a convenient word we can all agree on. But we're not talking about, in my own case, disclosure of anything even remotely classified or secret or anything like that. What I saw in Iraq in terms of waste and fraud and corruption was visible to hundreds of people. There could have been any number of folks who could have written the same book. Yet, exposing it, bringing it out, doing the simple act of essentially writing down what I saw in front of me over that year has pushed me into this category of whistleblower. My intention was to write the book. I expected to get a slap on the wrist from the State Department for being a little naughty and that type of thing, but I certainly was not expecting the tidal wave that swept over me and has changed me. What I have come to understand is that whistleblowers, and I'll use that term just for lack of a better word at this time, whistleblowers, that we're not born. We're not something where someone says, I can't wait to kind of let everybody know about something I've discovered. We're made. We're created. We're created by governments, by our government that insists on overclassifying things, by creating a culture of secrecy. We're made by bosses that won't listen to us, that blow us off, that aren't interested in criticism or dissent or critique. We're made by a system of government that insists on operating in secrecy, preventing the people of the United States from fulfilling their obligation to monitor the government, to make sure the government does what it wants. And because we are made by this system, shutting me up, shutting Sybil up, shutting Tom Drake up doesn't solve anything, because there's another one behind us, and one behind him or one behind her.
But Peter, doesn't it set an example that most people will acquiesce to? The treatment of Bradley Manning,
yep,
of Tom Drake, and we haven't even gone into detail about the hazing of Peter Van Buren. We will in a moment. But this is not about you as much as sending a signal to the rank-and-file members of the State Department that if they step out of line, they're going to get to walk the halls.
Two sides of the equation get to send signals, Peter. And yes, about 90% of what's been done to me is not about me or about my book. It's about the other people in the State Department. It's about the book that's easiest to censor is the one that's never written. The voice that's easiest to silence is the one that never speaks up. And so, sure, my head on a pole in the State Department lobby for everyone to see is indeed what the department's intent is here. I'm a warning. I'm a message. But two sides can play that game. I'd like to warn your audience that they are committing an act of civil disobedience right this moment. The State Department has told me that when I speak publicly without their permission, and of course they never grant the permission, I am acting insubordinate. I am committing insubordination. I am refusing their direct orders and that act of insubordination carries penalties with it. Well, I'm doing it. And by listening to me, your listeners are participating in that act of civil disobedience. And I would argue that shows like this and people like you that are willing to offer us a chance to commit those acts are sending a message as well. And so I'd like to hope, and I'm an optimist, that someone out there who's trying to decide whether to act on his or her conscience is listening to this and realizing that there are ways to do this, that there are people out there who will help you. There are lawyers that will work with you. There are people who have been down this path who can give you advice so that you skip some of the obvious beginner's mistakes we've all made and take advantage of that and act on your conscience. So it's two sides can play this game, and I say let's send an example right now.
Well, you make some excellent points, Peter, but, you know, we started the National Security Whistleblowers Coalition in 2004, and right after 9/11, that was a big catalyst for a lot of government employees, especially those people within the agencies such as the FBI, CIA, and the Pentagon, and the TSA, formerly FAA, people to come forward because they believe, my God, I mean, some of these people knew a bunch of things, and they believe that maybe if they had had acted upon these documents or information, maybe they could have had saved lives. So that led to many, many whistleblowers coming forward. It was this flood. And I agree with you about the term whistleblowing. And for years, I fought just the term. I thought, I'm not a whistleblower. I don't even like the terminology. But just like you, I'm like, okay, since there are no other words to describe this, I am going to go with whistleblowers, the term to describe what we have done, who we are. But so we have many, many whistleblowers coming forward. Just during the first 2-3 years of National Security Whistleblowers Coalition, our organization, I would tell you easily, every month we had 5 to 10 government whistleblowers who are still with the government coming forward, contact us, as I said, DEA, TSA, and Bush administration, they, you know, it was pretty hard on whistleblowers. But nothing like the current administration, because during the entire Bush presidency administration for 8 years, not a single whistleblower was taken to court, criminally prosecuted under Espionage Act, threatened, you know, not a single whistleblower was jailed. Now, with the Obama administration, as Peter just mentioned, we have had Bradley Manning, and it was the persecution of Thomas Drake. Now he won in his case. Then we have, you know, Sterling, and now we have the new. So actually, and before that, even before Bush administration, the only whistleblower our government tried to prosecute was Dan Ellsberg, Pentagon Papers, Dan Ellsberg, which didn't go through with the courts. So Obama, President Obama is the first and the only president we've had who has been actually prosecuting truth-telling and whistleblowing. And interestingly, when you look at the number of whistleblowers coming forward, you know, outside you and Drake, in the last 3 years, our organization, we haven't been getting many whistleblowers. And the few we have been getting, they actually tell us that no way they are going to come forward or at least talk to the media or get their have their name known because of the chilling factor, the chilling message sent by this administration. So actually, this administration has succeeded in further silencing truth-telling and whistleblowing in the government. So that part is negative. And as far as, you know, with all of us, all the experienced whistleblowers, having gone through all the congressional track and through all the court mazes and of course, the mainstream media, and as you know, they are not very kind with whistleblowers, or they carry them as a headline 1 or 2 days, then they drop the case. They don't pursue these cases as an ongoing pressure point on our politicians. our advice has changed. We used to tell our whistleblowers or people who were planning to blow the whistle to pursue the so-called channels. You know, go to Congress. Oh, you're FBI, so you should go to the Judiciary Committee and or the Intelligence Committee, and go to the IG, Inspector General's office, go get a good attorney and, you know, have a... We don't know of many whistleblowers, if any whistleblowers, who have actually succeeded. Do you remember or can you recall a single case, whistleblower case, Peter, that has succeeded in the United States Congress in terms of bringing about accountability or hearings, real hearings? I'm not talking about cosmetic hearings. Can you think of one in the past 10 years, Peter?
I'm a little bit short on that one, but
zero.
I'm going to retain a shred of optimism, a shred of hope here by reminding people who are out there and thinking about an act of conscience to take a look at whistleblower.org, the website, whistleblower.org, which is the website of the Government Accountability Project. People that I've worked with, and I know you have too, Sybil, and they've got information there for people who are considering an act of conscience, an act of whistleblowing, if you will, to help them weigh out the decision, to help them understand the consequences and the impact of their decision, and also to invite them to learn more about an office that has languished under a number of presidents that may offer a little bit of help, and that's the Office of the Special Counsel. The office was created in 1979, way back under the Carter administration, to do two things primarily. One was to assist whistleblowers who received protection under the Whistleblower Protection Act, and the other was to look into the Hatch Act, which is an obscure thing in government that says government employees have limited rights to participate in political campaigns. That's kind of faded a bit. The Office of the Special Counsel, OSC, has never really got funded, never really got off the ground through a couple of administrations. Under the George W. Bush administration, the office was actively destroyed. The Bush administration appointed a gentleman named, and I use gentleman in air quotes there, Scott Block. Scott Block was a neoconservative who believed that he should not pursue cases of discrimination based on sexual orientation because he believed gay people were evil. He believed that there was no such thing as gender discrimination, and he never followed those cases. And he decimated the office during the 8 years that he ran it. Good news is that once Bush got out of office, Scott Block's own employees filed suits against him, and Scott ended up going to jail for a month. It was only a month, but hopefully he met some nice people while he was there. The Office of the Special Counsel now is run by a woman named Carolyn Lerner, ironically an Obama appointee, and she was supposed to go there and be a figurehead and kind of keep the lights on so that everyone could say we've got this office. But instead, what she's done, and she was profiled in the Washington Post, and people can Google her name and read this, Carolyn Lerner, what she's done is revitalized the office. It's a slow process. It's government still. It doesn't happen quickly or sharply or with great vigor. She has, however, brought some smart lawyers in, and I will hold out just this tiniest bit of hope that she will find a way to maybe do some good. I put my case in her hands. We have filed a complaint on my behalf with the Office of the Special Counsel, charging that the Department of State has retaliated against me because of my book and my blog, and that retaliation is illegal and unconstitutional. The Office of the Special Counsel is conducting an investigation. If we are successful and they do agree that the State Department retaliated against me, they have the power to order the State Department to make me whole. I'm not quite sure what that'll actually entail. Maybe they'll let me come back to work. Maybe they'll take my head off a stick. Maybe they'll stop throwing rocks at me every time I get near the building. I don't know exactly what will come of it, but it will set a precedent, and it will remind the Department of State that bullies can still get kicked down.
Okay, wow. Peter, I really admire your optimism, and actually it's admirable because it's good to be optimistic. But since 2007, after going through all the mazes of Congress, not on my case, but over 100 whistleblower cases, and these are from the government agencies, since 2007, I have joined Dan Alsberg and Colleen Rowley and Ray McGovern. And our advice has been to government employees who know of, and I'm not talking about justifiably classified things, such as, let's say, informant's identity, but cases that are being classified because they want to, the government wants to save embarrassment or because it's engaged in criminal activities, we advise them to totally bypass these so-called channels such as IG. You know, this is the same executive branch with FBI and DOJ. The boss for the IG office, Inspector General's office, happens to be the same bosses who are engaged in criminal operations and activities and silencing whistleblowers, meaning back then it was Ashcroft, today is Criminal Holder and Mueller. So they're basically, they are answerable not to Congress, the IGs, but to their bosses, who are the people who are engaged in wrongdoing. So do not go, do not waste time, because you basically provide them with more ammunition to come after you. And this is for the agencies, and I'm saying this as a whistleblower who got from the FBI the only truly positive IG report saying I was right. Despite that fact, all that information was used against me by the FBI and in court. The second advice we give to people, save yourself time and energy and don't be naive. Do not go to Congress. As you know, most of these people, and look at their campaign financing and see who they represent and look at the track record. Look at the Congress in the past 10, 11 years and see whether or not this Congress has held a single executive branch criminal responsible, whether Bush or Cheney, whether it was on torture or illegal eavesdropping, none. How many subpoenas this Congress has issued? None. How many whistleblowers this Congress has protected and defended? None. Not single. You won't even find hearings, real hearings, on single whistleblowers, despite hundreds of cases. Don't do that. As far as the NGOs, first, before you contact them, go to their About Us section. See who funds these people. And if you see the names George Soros or you see Rockefellers, and that's the entire family, and all the big corporations, including the Rockefeller who was in the Senate Intelligence Committee, who helped cover up NSA illegal eavesdropping, you know you don't want to go and deal with these pimps. Because how could you trust organizations that are funded by the same criminals you're fighting and countering? Don't do that. If the information is important, I am going to repeat Dan Alsberg's message, and that is find a safe way and make that information public for the public's right to know. Save yourself trouble, because the courts are not going to serve you unless you have deep pockets and you can hire attorneys for $400 or $500 per hour, or you have incredible level of publicity that the ACLU or EFF or someone is willing to take on your case. So on behalf of 150 whistleblowers who has gone through all this stuff, I urge the listeners, do not approach these minefields, because you either get burned or you end up wasting years of time, and the information you have that may save lives or may prevent further torture or maybe further abuse by the executive branch, well, you have basically defeated your purpose. Why would you even decide to blow the whistle if you're blowing it in the halls of these palaces ruled by the same criminals you're blowing the whistle on? And that is our advice. Now you, Peter.
there's little one can add to that. The point I would make with anyone who was considering an act of conscience was to understand that there are support groups, there are lawyers out there who will work with you at low cost or no cost. This is not something that one does on one's own, at least not intelligently. Take advantage of the fact that others have gone before you and made some mistakes. This is a push and pull between the rights of people, the rights of American citizens under the First Amendment to speak out and know what their government is doing, and the government which wants to stop them. It is a push and pull, and you want to understand that, and understand that when you insert yourself into that process, you will get pushed and pulled around. Don't do it alone. Don't do it without advice. Don't do it without legal advice. Don't do it without advice for people to help you understand the emotional ride that you're going to embark on. And take advantage of these resources, and take advantage of the fact that there's people out there who want to help you.
Peter Van Buren, I have not been through the process that Sabelle has, and she clearly has strong feelings from that that history. But I have been in touch with a man that I met through the National Security Whistleblowers Coalition. His name is Joe Carson, and he's not in the national security arena. He's a nuclear engineer for the Department of Energy. And he has blown the whistle inside his department quite often over the last 20 years and succeeded in changing some of the policies. His issues relate to the safety of nuclear reactors that he works on in the Tennessee Valley Authority. But he recently carried a petition campaign to the White House related to the Office of Special Counsel. And one of the assignments of the OSC is to write a report every year about the Merit Service Protection Board and to what extent individuals may or may not have been improperly discharged or otherwise retaliated against. And Carson points out that the OSC has failed to publish or even complete that report since the law, I believe, in 1978 was passed that created it. And so while I don't have that personal experience that Sabelle operates from, I have to say that even with the change to Carolyn Lerner that you find at least somewhat promising, it doesn't appear that there is any real drive for this office to actually do its job.
It's a very difficult process, and I'm not familiar with Joe Carson's situation. And as a Foreign Service officer, the jurisdiction does not fall under the Merit Services Board. It falls under the Foreign Service Grievance Board. Mm. A little inside baseball there for you. So okay. I can't really speak specifically to those things. What I can say is that every one of these systems is imperfect. It's government, and government at its best is clumsy and big and slow-moving. One has to decide whether to be optimistic and think that there's a way forward, or one has to say, no, there's not. And I choose to think that there is a way forward. It will be bumpy and it will be imperfect, but I'm putting my hat in that circle and hoping that things will go well. Mm-hmm. Peter, your job is to call us back in a couple of months and say, how did it go? Who was right?
Well, and you and I discussed this, it was August or September when I talked with you about your book, and you were concerned about possible retaliation, but it didn't appear that it had really taken shape yet. So take a moment here to describe what they have done to marginalize you as an employee without actually firing you.
What's happened is that the State Department has taken a number of, if you will, extra legal steps to shun me, ostracize me, kick me out of the tribe, vote me off the island, whichever. It began in late August when the security people at the State Department, once again, that word security, claimed that a link on my blog, not a leak, a link to a WikiLeaks document constituted me divulging classified information. Mm. And with a stroke of a pen, with no oversight, with no avenue of complaint or ask for anyone to review it, security people took away my security clearance that I had held for 23 years. No avenue of appeal, gone.
Right. Right.
Without a security clearance inside the government, you might as well hope to find work as a janitor, if at best.
Mm-hmm.
What happened after that was I was thrown out of the job that I was doing. I had been doing it for the State Department for a year after I returned from Iraq. I was pretty good at it, enjoyed doing it, and boom, one day, clean out your desk, let's go. I was sent home after that on what they called administrative leave, which is essentially, we can't fire you right away, but we're working on it, and we want you out of the way while that process unfolds. Like civil servants, as a Foreign Service officer, there are certain protections in place. It's not a fast process to fire somebody. It's not like a private company where you can say, boom, you're out. It's much closer to what academics enjoy as tenured professors at universities. After being sent home and again benefiting from some very good legal advice, we fought back against the State Department. They said, nope, not yet, and they took away my badge. I can't enter the building. They banned me from the facilities. They cut me off of the computer networks. They took away my diplomatic passport. Security started asking questions of my colleagues and former friends to try to alienate them. We kept pushing, and they reluctantly granted me telework status, which I thought might be a step forward. Turns out that there was not a lot of telework to be done. And so the State Department left me in this netherworld where I am a teleworker without much of an assignment.
So you're a diplomat without portfolio, without a diplomatic passport, without a security clearance. You basically, all of the tools of your trade have been taken away from you. And I take it you still get a full paycheck. And do they actually assign you work? Does somebody check to see if you're on duty like right now?
I get these kind of vague assignments. They were things that might have challenged an intern a few years ago, but they're certainly not even close to commiserate with someone with 24 years of experience. They are just kind of a shadow, a way to claim that they've kept me employed. We're going to keep fighting that, and we're going to keep pushing back against that. But I'm afraid that time will run out. The State Department has also pushed me, using their internal personnel system, into a category that prevents me from getting another job inside of the State Department. Our system is such that every 2 or 3 years we move around and we get reassigned. It's very different than what civil servants experience, where they tend to stay in the same job or the same job column for most of their careers. The State Department has manipulated the rules so that I will be forced out no later than September of this year. And so, in a sense, they won. And I hate to switch from my optimism at this late stage in the interview, but in a sense, they have won. They're forcing me out in no later than September, maybe sooner. But I'm going to be kicking and fighting all the way out the door, and I will be taking advantage of as many opportunities as I can to speak publicly, to write publicly, so that people do understand what's happening here. If the State Department wants the juice, they're going to have to tolerate the squeeze. And it's going to be a bumpy road for the next 7 months, but it's something I'm willing to do.
And so have they essentially put you on notice that you're in a termination process?
Yes, and it's a dual-track termination, if you will. They can be efficient people after they've had a chance to kind of gear up to it. They are actively seeking to toss me out the door, basically claiming I am insubordinate by continuing to exercise my First Amendment rights, as I'm doing right now. And that track is off and running. But then they've also been a little bit more clever about it and bureaucratically pushed me into a category where, when my current assignment, such as it is, runs out in September, I will not be able to get another one, and therefore forced into retirement. It's a bureaucratic thing. It's nothing that one can defend oneself against. It's a twisting of the rules, but it's a very effective track. So one way or the other, if I'm not out sooner, I'll be out no later than September.
Mm-hmm. And, Peter, one of the items I noted in your article that was posted recently is you wrote, "My Freedom of Information Act request for documents to help defend myself and force state to explain its actions has been buried."
Yes.
And I wanted to just tip you off that my colleague Jason Leopold, the investigative reporter at truthout.org, published a piece recently that discloses that there is a system called blackballing.
Mm.
And when you make a FOIA request, they don't have to reveal to you that something has been blackballed. But there is a control file that is started when you make the first request. And if you ask properly, they have to release the control file to you, which can actually show that a certain request was blackballed.
I am typing as you're talking, Peter. This is new information and important to me, and I think important to all your listeners as well.
Well, it's fascinating because it actually surfaced on the part of a scholar who was investigating whether Malcolm X had an FBI file. And whether a previous researcher on Malcolm X, who'd written a book about him, had a file. And when what happened was he got in touch with one of the people at the FOIA response section, and they kind of coached him or gave him a couple of tips on the right keywords to use. And so that's something that I've recently learned about FOIA, that despite the proclamation that President Obama made shortly after taking office, that he wanted the administration to be open, he wanted the government to be accessible, and FOIA was a central focus of that, it's pretty clear that they have a lot of back-channel ways to administratively ditch requests that would produce embarrassing information. And this once again gets back to a point you raised earlier about unnecessary secrecy, where things are classified to prevent embarrassment, not to prevent actual disclosure of sensitive information.
Oh, of course, of course. I want to take a moment just because I picked the optimism theme up here. One of us had to do it, to point out the point you made there about someone inside the system let your friend know about this this request for the control file.
Mm-hmm.
That in itself is the equivalent of an act of successful whistleblowing. That's somebody on the inside who could have said, sorry, first come, first serve, and yep, let it go at that. But he or she knew there was another way and maybe wasn't ready to stand up and tell the newspapers about it or come on the radio and talk about it. But still, let that information out in a way that he or she knew was going to find its way to the right people. And as long as there's folks like that inside the government willing to do that, I think there's a little shred of sunshine out there we don't want to abandon too quickly.
Yeah, interesting. So, Belle, is there anything you'd like to add here?
Oh, I just want to leave in some sort of a positive note because otherwise it will be embarrassing here. I really, really appreciate Peter's quote, optimism attitude. But also I think it is a very important element that I hope he will maintain, and that is to keep that sense of humor and the spirit because, as you know, Peter, common to, you know, meet whistleblowers and talk with them, and they have been so badly beaten up, the spirit has basically, you know, disappeared, or the bitterness that constantly comes true. So I think that's very good, and it's one of those needed ingredients when you go out there trying to, you know, raise public awareness and educate people on this issue. So it's a very admirable trait, and I hope you'll maintain this, Peter. And I really, really enjoy your sense of humor.
Well, thank you, and I appreciate that. And I would say to folks that, sure, it's going to be a rough road, but sense of humor is one of those things. If I might have a last word, it would be just to encourage your listeners to drop in on my blog at wementwell.com. where I try to maintain a sense of humor about these things. Occasionally, there's outright satire or funny things, but oftentimes, it's an opportunity for me to alert people to things they might want to be looking into or reading, as well as keeping track of the developments in my own case. WeMeantWell.com.
And I want to recommend the book We Meant Well, because it is still quite relevant, particularly with the announcement in the last week or so, as you predicted in the book, of the scaling back of the mm-hmm. mega embassy in Baghdad. And what you disclosed in the book, as you pointed out earlier, is available elsewhere, but it's not collected with your point of view and with both the courage that you have to speak the truth and your self-deprecating sense of humor. And I really think that it's a great read, but it's an important book that really shows many Americans who probably haven't paid attention how our money and the goodwill of the American people were both squandered in huge degrees in our occupation of Iraq.
Well, I'm buying my coffee right away. In fact, as soon as I hung up here.
Well, thank you both for those kind words. You know, the book was called We Meant Well, but given how unfortunately accurate my predictions have been, I think I'm calling my next book I Told You So.
Peter Van Buren, thanks for joining us today.
My pleasure.
On The Boiling Frogs.
Thank you.
All right, Peter, that was excellent.
It was.
I will email you also the article from Jason Leopold about the FOIA issues.
Absolutely. Please.
And if you don't mind, I'll put you in touch with Joe Carson. He writes lengthy emails, so be prepared for that.
I to be honest with you, I do get Joe's emails now.
Oh, you do? Okay.
And Joe and I have a different opinion about the Government Accountability Project and a different opinion about the Office of the Special Counsel.
Mm-hmm.
And that's fine. He has more experience with this, and like I said, 6 months from now, I may be on his side with this.
Yeah, okay. Well,
right now, Joe and I are looking at it differently, and maybe his case is different than mine. I don't know.
No, that's just fine. I wanted you to be aware of the work he's been doing.
Absolutely, I am. But please do pass my email here to Sybil so that we can get in touch.
Almost definitely.
I will do that.
Looking forward to it.
All right, Peter, thanks again. And I will follow up in 3 months to see how you're doing, okay?
Thank you very much. And do shoot me an email when it's up online someplace so I can link to it on my blog.
Okay.
Thank you very much, and it's a pleasure to meet you, Sybil.
Nice. Meeting you too. Bye-bye.
Bye, Peter.
Joining us. We'll be back soon with more Boiling Frogs interviews.